ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When it comes to protecting our environment, some of the technology we have today is truly incredible. From powerful satellite cameras to sophisticated remote heat sensors, these tools all play a role in responding to threats, like bushfires. But at the end of the day, there's still no tech equivalent for real people in the sky, watching for warning signs of a bushfire.
While we have satellites that have amazing cameras, there's always a delay with them, and there's nothing better than the human eye between ourselves and the fire towers that are spread throughout the southwest as well.
It's been more than 50 years since the first fire spotter plane started patrols over the forests of Western Australia. Today, we'll meet the expanded squadron of young pilots who are carrying on the tradition on the aerial front line. I'm Alex Hyman, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk country, Perth. But firstly, imported red fire ants are an invasive pest. Native to South America, they were first detected in Brisbane in 2001, but in recent months they've been on the move. They pose a threat to the environment, to crops and to humans through their painful sting. This week, a Senate inquiry has been examining the impact of the aggressive pest across Australia, with a hearing in Brisbane yesterday and today in Newcastle. Our reporter Amelia Bernasconi was there listening, and she joins us now. Amelia, just for some background, where are these fire ants currently found and how big of a problem are they?
Well, Alex, it sounds like the problem's really come to the fore in the last 6 months, certainly for us in New South Wales. The red imported fire ants came to Australia back in 2001, actually. And there's been, quoted today was about 7 incursions in the years since that have been eradicated from other parts of the country. But we have seen them move now from southern Queensland down into northern New South Wales. And so quite timely, this inquiry was formed late last year. We also saw these incursions in New South Wales then. And the concern really is that, like you mentioned, particularly for human health, we have never had a death from a red imported fire ant, or RIFA as they've been referred to today. Never had a death in Australia from those bites, but it can cause anaphylaxis, and there's some serious health concerns that have been brought to the fore over the last day or so. And today it really turned to the impacts on the agriculture sector, and really comparing how this response is shaping up compared to the varroa mite response, which I'm sure you and your listeners are very familiar with.
So who has the inquiry heard from today?
Today we heard from, lots of agricultural bodies and also some experts, one particular of interest from the US, and they spoke about their experience over there, Dr. Robert Puckett. He's worked as an entomologist for the best part of 25 years, and he said that in the US they've had these red imported fire ants for nearly a century. So they're pretty well versed in this, although there's lots of variations, of course, between the US and Australia. But he shared some of their control methods. He spoke about a fly, which was of particular interest to the inquiry, that they've used to help them get on top of RIFA. But that fly is not a variety that we have in Australia at the moment. So that's a whole other big conversation around biocontrols and bringing new things in to tackle current problems. But he did say that he was pretty confident. He actually applauded Australia's efforts to date to stop the spread. You know, it's been more than 2 decades that we've had this problem. He said we should be applauded for controlling the spread as best Australia has done that to date. And he's pretty confident that we can actually eradicate this pest. He drew on the decades of research that's been done in the States and elsewhere in the world. So he's, you know, opened that door. He's coming out in August, I think, and he was very open to sharing with Australian governments, industry, the support and what they've found in the States so far. But yes, we also heard, it was a really busy day, but I suppose the other particularly interesting speaker we heard from today was Xavier Martin. He was quite fierce. He's the president of New South Wales Farmers Association, and I'm sure you'd recall that, you know, this varroa mite response, a huge biosecurity incursion that broke out at the Port of Newcastle back in June of 2022. So, you know, our state's farmers have been not on edge, but I guess hyper aware of biosecurity threats and risks and the possibilities of the impacts that they could have. So there was lots of likening today between the response, the communication, the transparency around varroa mite, and how hindsight on that incursion could help influence what's done going forward as we see red imported fire ants breach the border into New South Wales. So there was lots of comparisons made there. But Xavier Martin did get a little bit fired up. He said his members are infuriated with the amount of levies they pay, and he feels that there's been too much chatter and not enough action.
Farmers are paying their levies year in, year out to try and contribute to the management of these biosecurity risks. But the reality is every day there's passengers coming in through our airports, through our shipping terminals, containers, all these other risks come in and they virtually get in scot-free. And if they do the wrong thing, they barely get a parking fine. You know, it's just nonsense the way we're running the show. And so we've got to get real. There's more than 1,000 pests that this island does not have that exist around the rest of the planet. And we're losing the battle, 2, 3 or 4 of them every month. Now, they're not all shockers like red imported fire ants, but this one will change our life. It will change the fauna, which then changes the flora, and then changes the way people live. You will not be walking in the park. The parks will be closed because of red imported fire ant infestations.
Xavier Martin there from New South Wales Farmers, painting a rather bleak picture if the red fire ants take hold here in Australia. Now, Amelia, it's not just an agricultural problem. We're also hearing about the potential health implications and the risk they pose to Australia's outdoor lifestyle, as Xavier mentioned there, perhaps closing off parks. Was much of that mentioned in the hearing today?
Not as much today, but I understand this was quite heavily covered in yesterday's hearings up in Queensland. So, yeah, there were allergy bodies making submissions to the inquiry saying that, you know, like you touch on, you know, they could pose major health risks if they're not brought under control. They want widespread immediate eradication programs for these ants. And we did hear a little bit today about education and how the community is educated around this. I wouldn't be able to spot a red imported fire ant if it happened to be in my backyard. And I think, you know, a lot of people would be in a similar boat there. So there's been definitely discussions about education of the community, because it's not just an agricultural problem. This is something for the whole community to tackle. There was also discussions about bringing industry and research bodies together and how they could potentially take charge in this. But there's lots of questions being put out, lots of conversations being sparked, and hopefully some answers to come of all of this. The inquiry moves from Newcastle, where it's wrapped up today, to Canberra later this month, and we're expecting a full report back from this committee by mid-April.
Our reporter in the Hunter Valley is Amelia Bernasconi. Amelia, thanks so much for speaking to Australia Wide.
Thanks, Alex.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
And you are with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company. The South Australian Government has released their annual analysis of blood lead levels for people living in the mid-north town of Port Pirie. The lead and zinc smelter there has caused its residents to have an ongoing exposure to lead for 135 years. The latest results show that the blood lead levels of children under 5 and pregnant women are still rising 10 years after tests began. The state government and owners of the smelter say they are doing all they can to reduce lead levels, but some in the community remain cautious. Vicky Natafalis has this story.
Around 2.5 hours north of Adelaide, the South Australian town of Port Pirie has roughly 17,000 people. It also has a lead and zinc smelter. Since its establishment in 1889, lead-contaminated dust produced in the smelting process has been carried by wind over the town, onto houses, businesses, schools and people. SA Health has tested the blood lead levels of children under 5 and pregnant women. Their analysis released in February this year show both of those groups have had an increase in their blood lead levels. The Targeted Lead Abatement Program has been trying to reduce the town's exposure to lead. It's a joint initiative between the state government and smelter owner Nearstar. Here's TLAP's Executive Director, Peter Dolan.
It's a mixed report. We're always disappointed because we want every child to be below 5 micrograms per deciliter, and we're clearly nowhere near that yet.
The number of children under 5 whose blood lead levels were above 5 micrograms per deciliter has increased by 1.6% from 2022 to 2023. The number of children whose levels were equal to or exceeding 20 micrograms per deciliter doubled. For pregnant women, the levels increased by 6.25%. However, the number of 2-year-olds with a blood lead level above 5 micrograms per deciliter decreased by 1.3%. Down from 76.9% to 75.6%. Mr. Dolan says the results of the two-year-olds bring some hope.
The results for two-year-old children have improved a lot, and that's really great because that it's at 2 years of age that the hand-to-mouth behaviour and things that children do are most prevalent.
In turn, the study states that blood lead levels measured at the time of children's second birthdays are considered to be robust indicators of lead exposure for the whole population. But the community is divided on whether they feel safe living in Port Pirie.
Me and some of my friends sometimes discuss this in school as much as we can when we're free.
That's primary school student Lilith Evans.
One of my friends who has asthma really is stressed about it, so I always help him talk about it.
Her mother, Rebecca Evans, says the issue was front of mind when her kids were little.
I was monitoring it a lot when the kids were younger. Now they're a bit older, I don't watch it as much, but I am cautious about outside areas. I was cleaning a lot more when they were younger, and I was doing regular checks with TLAP to make sure they were okay. TLAP's doing their best with continual cleanings and advising schools and students and parents of how to keep the lead levels low at home, but outside that, it's really up to the government to step up and try and help it.
But fellow local Philip Hensel says he feels totally safe.
I reckon it's safe. I watch the Pasminco cleaners go around with the hoses and stuff like that, and they do a bloody marvellous job. Maybe the soil from years ago is contaminated, but a lot of people have got nice gardens in and lawns and stuff like that.
Executive Director of Health Protection and Regulation from SA Health, Chris Lees, says work is being done to reduce lead levels in the community.
We've got groups like the Environmental Health Centre and the Targeted Lead Abatement Program that work with particular households to remove lead in their environment. But of course, we do need to reduce the lead in the environment more broadly, and one of the key ways of doing that are things like greening of the environment, reducing those dust reservoirs where legacy lead occurs, and of course, improving the performance of the smelter as well to reduce lead in there.
In a statement, the smelter owner Nearstar says they are included in projects and programs that reduce local children's lead levels. They say they're focused on continuing to implement short and long-term initiatives and infrastructure upgrades that improve Port Pirie's lead-in-air concentrations. TLAP's Peter Dolan says there's no quick fix to reducing lead exposure in Port Pirie.
We are playing a long game, if you like. We've got 132 years of operations of the smelter. We've got emissions over a long period of time. There's a lot of lead in the environment. It'll take us quite a while to resolve that issue, and we're going to keep working on those long-term strategies. So an example would be greening of Port Pirie. That's going to stop dust moving. Greening projects of a large scale take a while. You've got to get the seed, you've got to prepare the soil and so forth. And so they're not immediate. They'll take a couple of years to actually have an impact.
Vicky Nataphalos with that story from Port Pirie.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
It's a species that I have been fighting for.
Growing up in the bush is such a special thing.
So when the rain does come, we've got a few numbers.
What
got
if it never comes?
Put a feather in your cap.
ABC Radio.
Let's head to Western Australia now, where the local heroes have traded their capes for wings. High above the towns, forests and farmland of southern WA, the state's first line of defence against bushfires is out on patrol. Throughout the fire season, for hours at a time, keen-eyed pilots crisscross large areas of bushland searching for any sign of smoke. And with this region's track record of devastating bushfires, their work is invaluable. From Manjimup in the southwest of WA, reporter Mark Bennett has this story.
Bronwyn Prinsloo loves looking for trouble. From her tiny plane above the southwest, she's on the lookout for the first signs of a bushfire to raise the alarm with other fire spotters on the ground.
Because while we have satellites that have amazing cameras, there's always a delay with them, and there's nothing better than the human eye between ourselves and the fire towers that are spread throughout the southwest as well.
The 25-year-old is a senior pilot based at Manjimup.
How many pilots are within the scheme?
So we have, I know there's three of us chicks. And then so Jandakot currently have seven pilots, so six flying pilots as well as our chief pilot. Bunbury have three pilots and we also have six pilots who work out of here.
The fire lasted 4 days, but the damage to the forest is everlasting.
A service that began in the 1970s following catastrophic fires around Pemberton in 1969.
One of the reasons for the enormity of the fire was the lack of adequate surveillance equipment when it first broke out. However, the department now believes it has the answer to the problem. It's just introduced daily aerial inspections of all major forestry areas.
Back then, the forestry department used small Cessnas, operating out of Collie. Now the service flies US-made scout aircraft, designed to fly low and slow.
Once you slow it down, so generally we'll cruise sort of between 100 to 110 knots is the speed that they say we'll fly at. But generally, if we need to, we can pull the power back and we can fly around sort of 80 to 70 knots. So they've got brilliant visibility between the wide windscreen and the big windows. We can see very far and very wide. There's nothing that really obstructs our view inside.
The pilots talk to fire spotters in 13 towers, forming a network of observers covering thousands of kilometres.
So you fly solo in these little aircraft. What sort of period of time do you go up for?
Yeah, so we're by ourselves when we're doing our detection side of the job. Our flights are anywhere from an hour to 2 hours typically. If we start finding smokes that can be extended, because obviously our priority is to deal with the smokes, so we'll stay up for as long as required.
Does it take a while to get your eye in to look for this sort of thing? Because there's a very big horizon out there.
There is, yeah. It does take getting some used to between looking for the smokes, knowing what to look for, because some of them obviously start quite small, which is ideal for how we find them. Obviously, the bigger ones are easier to see. Lots of people can see the bigger ones, but definitely picking out the little ones before they get big is quite... you got to get your eye in for that, definitely.
How do you maintain concentration and really stay on the games?
Sometimes it does get quite hard, as with any job. If you do it for extended periods of time, sometimes you get a little bored, but you just got to remember that you're looking after the community, and it's really important what we do. The quicker we can find the fires, the quicker we can dispatch ground crews and aircraft to it to deal with it.
What drew you to this particular service?
So when I was 11, I was watching the helitax fill up at a lake by my house in Balladura, and I just turned to Mum and went, I'm going to do that. But helicopters are very expensive to get into, so I took the fixed-wing path, and I think it was about 2014 I found out about the Parks and Wildlife fire spotting job and just made it my goal from then on. And it's real rewarding knowing you've helped find a fire early and get it dealt with before it becomes anything major.
That's our reporter Mark Bennett speaking there with senior pilot Bronwyn Prinsloo in WA's Southwest.
ABC Australia Wide.
And finally here on Australia Wide, Australia is home to some of the most breathtaking landscapes found on the planet. So it makes sense then that the beauty of Australia would be used as a spectacular backdrop for a new locally produced computer game. Wayward Strand is an immersive role-playing story that was released last year. It's set on an airship that hovers above Victoria's Bass Coast. And last week, it won the Best Narrative Award at the Free Play Independent Games Festival Awards. It stars the voices of actors Michael Caton and Anne Charleston and is designed to develop empathy, social skills and intergenerational relationships in young teenage players who are tasked with entertaining, making conversations and forming relationships with the residents of a flying aged care facility. Cell reporter Rachel Lucas spoke with game designer and art director of Wayward Strand, Goldie Bartlett.
Hi, my name is Marigold Bartlett. I'm an art director for a studio called Ghost Pattern, and we make heartfelt video games about being Australian and growing up.
And you've made a video game set in Gippsland. Tell us about Wayward Strand.
It's a team of about six on the core team, maybe seven, depending on the month, worked on Wayward Strand for a total of 7 years, and we released it at the end of 2023, and it's about a teenage girl in 1978 down in Gippsland. Her relationship with her mother, who's the head nurse of a flying hospital airship, the main player character, Casey, who's 14, her relationship with all of the staff and patients on board the hospital. It's a really modern style of video game design, which is sort of story first rather than any complicated controls, and we worked really hard to make it as accessible as possible to people who might not have played games before. And it was also made in consultation with the Bunurong Land Council. It's just a heartfelt, poetic little piece. In a way, it's a love letter to the Bass Coast and to Australia from our perspectives, as kind of built through stories that have been told to us by our grandparents and our parents.
Your job is to go to each of the patients' rooms and spend some time with them. Got that?
Yep.
The name's Esther. What's yours?
Casey.
Casey. Very original. Now, if you'll excuse me, I've got to go solve a mystery about a goat.
Is this you?
Oh, yes, that's me. And the family.
Would you like some company?
Of course. Be warned, I am writing up a storm at the moment.
You were in the war?
We escaped. And myself.
As a player, what's the goal of it? Is it navigating the world?
Pretty much, yeah. It's a new way of storytelling, interactive storytelling, which is dealing with ensemble casts. And so the gameplay really is about you're kind of stuck on this ship for 3 days. Your mum can't babysit you. She's asked you to come and spend time on the ship while she's at work. You're really tasked to just keep the patients company. So through conversations with the people on board the ship, the drama and the narrative kind of unfurls.
How are you finding your time on the ship?
I hear people talk about things, but I'm not sure what they're on about.
That sounds a bit like the life of an older person. Nobody explains to us what's going on. We just have to piece it together as best we can.
The unique thing about Wayward Strand and what we kind of get celebrated for is our unique approach to the narrative structure. So if you like lift the hood of this game, the mechanics are really novel and it's inspired heavily by interactive theatre like Sleep No More, for example, where all of the characters on board the ship are walking around to their own schedules. So if you're on the third deck having a conversation with a particular patient, there's going to be stuff happening on the other decks that you're missing. So you kind of get a unique version of the story depending on where you are at any given time during your playthrough. But it's also being carefully designed to feel complete no matter what your experience is. And I think the core behind that was about looking at the idea of player agency and how much agency would a 14-year-old kid actually have in this situation, and making sure that you aren't responsible for life and death situations. It's more about like who you choose to meet and just having beautiful conversations.
So sort of encouraging relationships, yeah, and intimacy and conversation and social skills, I guess.
Yeah, I like to say one of the core themes of it is like the getting of empathy. And so you're having all of these intergenerational relationships. Casey's kind of on the precipice of childhood and adulthood, or teenagehood really. And I think the game shows her learning that adults, in particular senior adults, are as human as she's starting to feel. It's sort of complicated in that way to it. It's fully voiced as well. We've got great actors like Anne Charleston and even Michael Caton came on board. We were hoping, I think, when we designed this to have a game that could be played between grandparents and their grandchildren that might incite conversation about that intergenerational care.
Casey Bomaris. My, you must have grown a mile a minute since I last saw you. Come in. Please, make yourself at home.
I saw a bit of recognisable Bass Coast landscape in there. It looks a bit like the prom in the background there. Looks very beautiful, the setting of this game. Immersive. It's almost like you're putting yourself in a film.
Yeah, I was the art director on this project, and the main thing I wanted to do was have, I had like the little brother or the little sister in mind who's watching the older sibling play. When the camera is still, I wanted every frame to have almost as much detail as like a children's book illustration so that they could pore over details. And I'm very inspired by Tintin and graphic novels. So, yeah, it's got a very cartoony, sophisticated kind of bent, an adult bent to it.
How did you get into this? Have you been playing video games your whole life?
Yeah, I've been playing them my whole life. I had three big brothers in the 90s. There's not a lot of women in this industry. I think we're under 20% of the industry in Australia, but it's growing. My main love was drawing and cartoons and visual art. And then because of the year I was born, I guess I just was lucky enough to get involved with computers, and that turned into digital art. And then the natural kind of pathway back in 2012 when I started going to uni was to study game design. Turns out it's a really interesting field with a lot of opportunity to express your creativity. I'm hoping Wayward Strand and all of the other amazing Australian indie games that are being made at the moment are going to provide a bit of a doorway for people who might have previously not been into games to come in and see them. We've had a hugely positive critical response. We're sitting on around 8 out of 10 across the board on like Metacritic and stuff, and we've had a lot of award nominations. We've got 5 nominations coming up this week at the Free Play Awards, which is really exciting, and just the feedback has been phenomenal. It's been really overwhelmingly positive.
That was game designer and art director Goldie Bartlett speaking with Rachel Lucas about Wayward Strand, an interactive video game that takes place in a flying aged care facility which hovers above Victoria's Bass Coast. And that is Australia Wide for this Tuesday. I'm Alex Hyman. I hope you can join me again tomorrow. Have a wonderful evening. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.